way. Senlin glanced at Edith, and saw, to his relief, that her expression had been softened by the receptionist's introduction. The receptionist changed monocles, located a pen, and said, "You're married?" Senlin said, "Yes." At the same moment Edith said, "No." This amused the receptionist, though he covered it by coughing into his hand. "I am married, but not to the good lady here," Senlin explained. "Of course." The receptionist pulled at the pronounced bulb of his nose. "Obviously, I know nothing of you or your ordeal, so if you'll indulge me, I'm going to run through a few questions which are quite tedious, I'm afraid, but which all will ensure that after today you are appropriately compensated for your troubles." Regarding them both through a single glazed eyepiece, he smiled. "Please, bear with me." Edith, for her part, was frank in her answers, though the question struck Senlin as being far afield from the matter at hand. She was 34. She was from the farmlands of southern Ur, near the town of Nice. She had spent 2 years at a women's finishing school, which she quit to return to work on her father's farmland, where she oversaw 200 of the family's 300 acres. She could ride a horse, repair a fence, and follow the rolling of the land to find water even in an arid valley. She was also recently divorced after 9 months of marriage. "And have you been to the parlour before?" the receptionist asked, still scribbling her answers down on his pad. For the first time, she seemed a little self-conscious. "I've spent the past 2 months here, going from one performance to the next. 6 shows in all, I think." "I hope those prior outings were happier than the present one," the receptionist said, kindly, and she gave a demure shrug. And then it was Senlin's turn. He wished he didn't have to recite his personal details while standing in a public hall. He tried to be stoic, but it wasn't long before he was mumbling and stuttering his answers. He felt the blood come to his face. He was an only child. His parents were deceased. He was well-educated and gainfully employed. He was married. He had no children. Confessing himself so succinctly embarrassed him in a manner he could hardly express. In short form, he seemed so unremarkable, so unaccomplished. Perhaps he was unremarkable, but he didn't feel that way. With the general interview complete, the receptionist thanked them for their patience. "Now, as to today's events, your case has been assigned to an assistant to the chief registrar, Mr. Arnen Seff. Mr. Seff is one of our most accomplished and thorough investigators. In a word, he is bright. You'll be temporarily, briefly, almost momentarily placed in a private room while Mr. Seff has a chance to gather up all the evidence of the case." The receptionist blinked the monocle from his eye, and it swung down to his chest front. He signalled over a tall, bald clerk, who seemed to have been sewn into his navy jacket. One could almost count the knobs of his spine. "The clerk here will show you through to your room, and I thank you both for your patience. You've been absolutely wonderful. I hope you'll recall me as fondly when you review your time here in the parlour." The gangly clerk led them from the grand hall, and after passing through another tangle of corridors, they entered a bustling hospital ward. It was familiar in every way, except, of course, for the lack of windows, which Senlin always associated with contemporary hospitals. Sun and fresh air were, after all, essential to recovery. They passed 2 carts, the first of which was filled with steaming bowls of porridge, and the second of which held 6 copper cylinders that were about the size of a milking pail. These might have passed for helmets, except that where one expected to find the faceplate, there was only a valve wheel that was nearly as wide as the rest of the apparatus. Senlin couldn't guess what medical service the device performed. Nurses padded around in soft white leather shoes, while patients with bandaged limbs and heads lay on cots in narrow, curtained spaces. The prospect of a clean bed and a nurse to wash their wounds filled Senlin with hope. He was shaken and exhausted and bruised. If he were at home, He would have gone to bed for a week and done nothing but read books and drink tea and listen to the waves recite their endless rhyme. But he was soon disappointed when the clerk ushered them on and out the other end of the ward into a narrow, warm, lime-washed chamber. Opposite them stood an iron hatch, 4 feet high, rust-flaked from the hinges.
"Assistant Seph will be by soon," the clerk said, unlocking the hatch with a heavy skeleton key.
Senlin and Edith looked at each other. She seemed apprehensive. He gave her a reassuring smile. It was a genuine and generous expression, and one that was quite rare on Senlin's face. The receptionist had charmed away his nervousness. Already, the whole terrorizing episode was beginning to soften and fade. The murders, the running, the hiding and breath-holding, all seemed to have happened to someone else. And yet, something was just the tiniest bit unsettling about the warmth of the room and the sudden vigilant expression of the clerk behind them. Senlin shoved these thoughts aside as the usual residuals of panic and fear. The hatch opened before them. They had to stoop to go through, and were confronted by a light so dazzling neither could see into it. The air felt hot as a breath on their faces. The clerk prodded Senlin forward with the heel of his hand. Senlin was about to turn and complain when the floor creaked and bowed like a rusted bedspring beneath him, throwing him off balance, confusing him. The hatch slammed shut. They listened as the bolt bit back into the strike plate. Still blind, Senlin struck his head when he tried to stand. He groped at the wire mesh above him, quickly discovered the corner, and there found the same wire links forming a wall. Squinting, he peered around. It seemed they were in something like a chicken coop or a rabbit hutch, suspended in a blue room. Then he realized he was looking at the sky. Not a painted sky, but the real blue heavens. They sat in a cage that was bolted to the face of the tower. Chapter 13. Ask anyone you meet, "Don't you miss the sun? Don't you miss the moon?" They'll reply, "Do you miss the heat stroke? Do you miss the howling wolves?" Every man's guide to the Tower of Babel. 100 feet below, the market sprawled, colourful and intricate as a patchwork quilt. Senlin beat fiercely on the black iron door. His commotion rattled the cage violently. Every joint creaked, and rust snowed down upon them. A wire link beneath them snapped. Edith urged him to stop, finally wrapping her arms around his neck. He could hardly hear her over his drumming. He chose not to hear her. The receptionist had promised them a speedy result and a private room. After everything he'd suffered through, he had to believe this was an oversight. A mistake had been made. Why would anyone ever come to the parlour? Was everyone a sadist? It was a madhouse. He banged on the door once more, panting his mouth dry. He let Edith pull him from the door. He collapsed almost on top of her and clung weakly to the wire wall to calm his vertigo. "Has this ever happened to you before?" he asked. "Do you really think I would come back if it had?" She seemed slightly more composed than him, though her voice still quavered. She looked down through the lattice of the floor. "How old is this cage? It looks like it could go at any moment." Senlin recalled in vivid detail the sickening sound the airship crew had made when they struck the earth.
"Let's talk about something else," Senlin replied through his teeth. He didn't want to think about who would pick through his pockets if he crashed to the ground.
Their coop was wire mesh on all sides, and about the size of a child's bed. There was sufficient headroom for them to sit with their backs to the linked wall, but not enough to stand. They had no choice but to crowd each other, which only added to Senlin's distress. He swallowed dryly and said,
"I don't understand. They know full well we did nothing wrong." "All the witnesses are dead. How could they know?" Edith asked.
Senlin explained his theory about the brass peepholes in the mansion walls and the spying clerks he'd seen in the backstage corridor. She tugged up the neckline of her dress, which had an awkward habit of slipping, and said, "It never occurred to me that anyone was watching. Oh!" She seemed to review a number of instances in her memory.
"Those peepholes were in every room."
"If it makes you feel any better, I don't think anyone is spying on us now," Senlin said, wiping at the sweat that streamed down his face. The sun bullied them mercilessly. He fashioned a little awning from his butler's coat by looping the sleeves through the ceiling mesh and pinning them on the exposed ends of wires. Edith spread out her thick skirts for him to sit on, which took some of the bite from the wire floor. He thanked her, as he might thank someone for making room on a park bench. They listened to the cacophony of the market, the camel brays and barker cries. The songs of distant train whistles were lifted up and then taken away by the arid wind. The sun's glare moved behind the tower, bringing on the artificial night. Senlin was better able to see the façade about them, and he found that studying it gave his mind a much-needed distraction. The walls were unpolished limestone. Here and there, old birds' nests tufted from the cracks between blocks. The nests appeared uninhabited. Other cages, similar to theirs and also uninhabited, were affixed some distance to their left and right. Looking up the tower through a gap in his coat awning produced such a strong feeling of vertigo in him that he could do little more than peek and look away. It didn't matter. There was little to see. Distant platforms protruded from the tower like thorns from a stem. He postulated that these might be airports, but it was only a guess. Otherwise, the façade appeared as vast and uninhabited as a desert. Except for the clockwork spider. The machine was the size of a large dog, and was at once frightening and marvellous when it crawled above the curvature of the tower. Steam gassed from the joints of its 8 steel legs. Its internal gears were visible through its copper skeleton. It was the most intricate and elegant clockwork Senlin had ever seen. As it drew nearer, he saw a red light, piercing as a ruby, glowing steadily at the heart of the machine. Senlin was too awed to be afraid of the chattering machine, but he was careful to remain silent when he pointed it out to Edith. She took in a quick breath and gripped his arm, but it was soon apparent that the clockwork spider was indifferent to them. It stalked with the surety of a fly on a wall, its feet shoed with dark rubber pads. Just when Senlin began to wonder if the thing wasn't some sort of grand toy, its function became clear. It was repairing the tower. It scoured the façade for flaws that it repaired by spraying some sort of gel. The gel appeared to harden quickly and soon glistened like quartz. Senlin watched the machine move from crack to crack, ripping out birds' nests and patching the gaps, until it had passed again out of sight. It was an ingenious little automaton, practical and efficient. Seeing it gave him a little hope. The tower was not all terror and confusion. There were wonders here, though all the wonders felt small and far away. Neither of them speculated aloud about how long they would be kept, or whether they would be brought food or water, or whether this birdcage was to be their coffin. Voicing such thoughts would only make the wait more unbearable. But after another half hour of silence, Edith gave a sudden, exasperated groan and said,
"My imagination is driving me mad. I've now reviewed every embarrassment that might have been watched by spies, and every possible manner that we could die in this coop."
Senlin cleared his throat.
"Me too. I just began to wonder how many vultures would have to perch on this cage before their weight combined with ours would be enough—"
"We have to talk about something else," she interrupted,
clapping her hands on the tops of her legs.
"So, your name is Thomas Senlin. You're a headmaster, and you are married."
This had come out during the receptionist's inquisition, of course.
"For many years?"
"No." Normally, his answer would have concluded there, but something pushed him now to confess more. Perhaps it was only out of camaraderie that naturally arises from shared trauma. Or perhaps, and he could hardly admit the possibility, He was dimly aware that the moment wasn't without intimacy, and that with intimacy came temptation. To stave off the whole guilty train of thought, he blurted out, "I'm on our honeymoon. We're on my honeymoon." He wouldn't have blamed her if she'd laughed, but she didn't, and her response was slow in coming. She stroked her cheek, scrubbing off dried blood. She seemed to be trying to decide whether to ask the obvious question, "Where is your wife?" He was a little surprised but relieved when she instead began to speak of her own past. Since there was nothing else to do, her anecdotes quickly evolved into a history. It became apparent to him that she meant to not just summarize, but also to embellish her story with all manner of small detail. He'd always been troubled by long-winded confessions. He never knew what to say. And yet, as she went on, he began to relax a little. She wasn't at all what he'd expected when he had first met her, in her peach dress, and she had ordered him about like a footman. She wasn't melodramatic or vain. She was quite likable, in fact. He liked her. She told him more about her family's farmland and the acreage she had been responsible for sowing. There was pride in her voice as she described her talent for farming. She knew when to sacrifice blighted rows. She knew how to manage buffer yields and droughts, how to ferret out the dishonest foreman, the drunks, and where to recruit replacements. She had two brothers, both older, neither of whom had any talent for or interest in the family business. Both managed small plots and did so poorly. Her yields were always superior. Her father, who wanted to spend his twilight years hunting and pressing the fruits of his orchards into cider, was proudest of her. He called her the generaless of the garden. Then, a little more than a year ago, her father had talked her into marrying a family friend, a man named Franklin Winters, who owned a modestly productive vineyard. She, the generaless, who needed no husband, had agreed only because her father pressed the point they both had tried for years to avoid. Her brothers were feckless, lazy, and worse yet, they were disloyal. If he left the land to them, they would only sell it and squander the profits. But he could not bequeath his fortune to an unmarried woman. She would be vulnerable to lawsuits, not least of all from her brothers. But if she were married, she would be safe from such attacks. She could continue to run the farm as she pleased. Mr. Franklin Winters was an inoffensive enough mate. He was a little gaunt of feature and bland of character, but he hadn't any debts, and his employees thought he was fair, which she took as good signs. Most importantly, he was amenable to her conditions for the marriage. Her role in the operations of the farm would not change. She would remain the generaless. He agreed, but had a caveat of his own. She could run the farm so long as it posed no risk to her health. Edith wasn't a fool. She knew that Winters expected her to become pregnant, and for that to be excuse enough to pull her from the field. Her father, too, held out hope that she would have children and continue the bloodline. She found the whole thing ridiculous. It was plain from her expression that motherhood held no charms for her. She agreed to Winter's request only because she knew it would never be an issue. She was hearty and stolid, but also barren, the result of a riding accident years earlier. It was a fact only she and the county doctor knew. The conditions were formalized, an agreement was signed, and they were married. But soon after she became Mrs. Franklin Winters, in a ceremony that she described as unsentimental, Franklin found an excuse to exploit their contract. She developed a slight allergy to a weed that grew everywhere in the spring along the lanes and the caps of rows. It was the same long weed that she had once habitually chewed on when roaming the freshly ploughed fields, checking the vitality of the soil. Now the weeds blooming made her wheeze. It was excuse enough for Winters to pull her from her horse. Never mind that half the foreman had one ailment or another, gout or syphilis or cataracts. She had to hang up her reins, shelve her clod stompers, tie a ribbon around her straw hat, and accept that she was too delicate to manage a farm. She suspected the whole thing was to punish her for not bringing forth a son. To be fair, Winters himself had been unable to offer much support to that venture. Senlin might have blushed if he hadn't already been so flushed from the heat.
"So you divorced him?"
"I did," she said, "though he hasn't returned the courtesy."
"I don't understand."
"I don't either."
She laughed, and a warm burst of wind tangled her dark hair about her face.
"He refused to give me a divorce, so I refused to stay."
"And so you came here?"
"To fritter his money. My money."
"And play a socialite's wife,"
Senlin said merrily, but saw her expression turn stormy. He grimaced apologetically.
"It was a stupid play."
She again forced down her ballooning crinoline skirts.
"I had to play dress stuffer while those two twits talked about business. Neither of them knew a thing about business. The stock market of the heart, please. If it's not quantifiable, it's not stock. That's the basic characteristic of stock. And as far as I know, no one knows how much love weighs, how voluminous it is, whether it can be divided or compounded. How many units of love does it take to make a romance? 5 love units? 20? Stock market of the heart. If the one twit hadn't gone berserk, I would have."
She was nearly raving, but there was a welcome edge of comedy to it. Before he could respond, the hatch in the iron door opened. They both crowded to it, and were met by a young man's face, smiling broadly under a carefully waxed moustache.
"My God, it's warm," the face said,
and a handkerchief briefly obscured it as he patted the frilly square across his forehead.
"You must let us in. This is ludicrous. We're in danger out here."
Senlin couldn't keep the desperation entirely from his voice.
"We've done nothing wrong."
"Yes, no, I understand. But I have to investigate your case first, or they'll just heave you right back in here."
"Then investigate faster," Edith said.
The youth cleared his throat.
"I am the assistant to the registrar. My name is Anan Seth, and I will be assisting you today."
The pattern of his speech was full of halts and gulps, and Senlin recognized in his manner a rank amateur.
"Faster,"
Edith repeated.
"I have concluded my inquiry, and I have reported my findings to the registrar, and he has returned with his decision."
"Who is the registrar? What is his authority?" Senlin interrupted. Seth smiled, the lines about his mouth rippling out.
"What wonderful humour!"
Then, just as quickly, his expression flattened like a swamp closing over a footprint.
"You, Mr. Thomas Senlin, will be escorted to the third floor, which is really very lovely. Do you like peacocks?"
"I have no opinion of them."
"The baths are filled with peacocks, and spas, and warm springs." "It sounds wonderful. Take us there," Edith said.
"Ah, well."
The grin wrinkled his nose, making him seem more juvenile, and he again cleared his throat.
"Ms. Edith Winters is not going to the third floor. She is being expelled to the first floor."
"Expelled? Why?"
Edith said.
"You locked me in with a murderer and I was attacked."
"Not me. I didn't lock you in any room, and you, as I understand, had a key and went into that particular stage house of the parlour voluntarily."
Senlin recognised in Seth's answer the slithering cowardice of an administrator. The boy was a blooming bureaucrat.
"There are two matters at issue. First, there is the issue of your exit, which was illegal. As you were told, characters must each exit into their original halls."
"We were being chased by a lunatic with a gun,"
Edith reiterated, jabbing her finger too near the youth's nose for his liking. He again waved his handkerchief over his face.
Yes, but there remains the second issue of the fires, Miss Winters," he continued. "You agreed, when you entered the parlour, to stoke the fires of the rooms you entered. We have much evidence of Mr. Senlin doing this small chore, but it appears that you, Miss Winters, were irresponsible with this charge. As a result, several fires went out.
"What does it matter? Get me a match and I'll restart them," she said.
"The damage is done, I'm afraid. You will be removed, and you will not be allowed to re-enter the parlour. That is the registrar's decision, and it—"
"Excuse me," Senlin interrupted, and using his lecturing voice said, "Young man, we are injured. We are perilously suspended over a great height. We are hungry and thirsty and frightened. I adjure you to return to your superior, your registrar, with a clear message. We will be freed, and we will continue, the both of us, to the baths. We insist that we be given a chance to account for ourselves in your courts, whatever they might be, and we insist that we be removed from this inhuman birdcage you've unjustly imprisoned us in."
He spoke with force and confidence he did not feel. This seemed to momentarily dash Seth's mask of officiousness, but he quickly gathered himself and recovered his smile.
"I will speak to him and return. In the meantime, I have supper."
Seth passed through the hatch a tin flask and a small sack of toughly crusted bread.
"Will you please let us wait inside?"
Edith said, restraining her anger for the moment. But Seth had already closed the hatch. She struck the closed plate with the heel of her hand.
"Numbskull!"
They collapsed back into their lounging positions, mute with frustration. Not a half mile in the distance, an airship banked over the market, seeming to have recently lifted off. From this angle, Senlin could make out the gondola, which was shaped like a square-nosed barge, and the heavy rigging that tethered the ship to the balloon. The voluminous envelope of gas was as round and red as a child's ball. Senlin felt a pang of envy. Oh, to fly! To be a balloon! To be a kite! Edith stared dumbly at the Byzantine sprawl of the market and said,
"You've heard what they do when they kick you out to make sure you can never come back, Tom."
She said in such a familiar way he felt disarmed.
"They're going to brand me."
Chapter 14. If you ever discover that you are bored in the parlour, wake up. You are asleep and having a tedious dream. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Ever since childhood, he had been fond of kites. He liked their serenity. A kite might tug and dive and lunge about, but it never panicked, not even if an unexpected gust snapped the line. The person flying the kite might panic, but the kite never did. He'd built box kites, shield kites, and sled kites of all shapes and sizes. Every month he'd order a new sheaf of coloured rice paper from Miss Burke's, and every month she would puzzle aloud over his chosen pastime. While other men in the village spent their idle hours repairing garden walls and framing rowboats, the headmaster was off in a field with a kite.
"How will you ever find a wife spending all your time on toys?" Miss Burke's wanted to know.
He didn't care. For many years, he just didn't care. He flew kites. Miss Burks rolled her eyes. It was a more romantic gesture than Miss Burks would have guessed when, late in their secret courtship, Senlin built Maria a kite and arranged an afternoon picnic. He constructed a simple diamond-shaped kite from red paper because it was her favourite colour. He chose a secluded, dramatic spot for their picnic, Woolgatherer Bluff. The bluff rose above the Pebble Cove, where Esau's fleet of fishing boats nodded on gentle waves. It was an uncommonly warm spring day. A steady wind blew inland. The only obstacle in the expansive field of clover was an old, fruitless apple tree. After launching the kite, he stood behind her, with his arms around her waist, holding her wrists as she gripped the spool of string. He said,
"The clouds give us a hint of what the wind is doing. See? We can see them stretch out and speed along and pile up together. But the kite shows the air in more detail. You can follow every jet and downdraft. It's like a flying weathercock."
She pulled at the kite string with a hooked finger
and bumped against him, saying,
"I was thinking the same thing. It's like a flying weathercock."
He knew her teasing was good for him. It kept him from being so terribly earnest all the time. And still he blushed and backed away a step. He took refuge in the lesson, explaining how to make the kite dive and swoop and rise. She listened and practiced and yelled at the kite as if it were a poorly trained dog. Senlin gave her more room and tried to keep from kibitzing. It wasn't long before the kite became snagged in the apple tree's branches. The collision occurred when Maria panicked at seeing the kite turn down from its towering perch and course straight down, directly at the solitary tree. Too excited to listen to Senlin's directions, she yanked hard on the line, which only sped the red missile on its way. The crash didn't upset him. He had destroyed whole flocks of kites over the years. Maria was more sentimental. She insisted that the token be rescued. Senlin suggested, quite reasonably he thought, that they could wait for a gust to free the kite. It might be a little torn, but it would be easy enough to repair. Maria insisted that she would save it, and while he protested, she stripped off her shoes and socks, knotted her skirt up above her knees, and began scaling the tree. Though he could hardly admit it, he was stirred by the sight of her bare legs wrapped about the branch. Despite the town's later suspicions, their courtship had been quite chaste. The limb swayed as she shinnied out toward the kite. Senlin made a conscious effort not to bite his nails. A moment more, and she had untangled the kite, shinnied back, and climbed down with it. Welts from the rough bark stood out on her arms and knees. She hardly noticed. She was giddy from her adventure, and only laughed when she tripped over a root buried in the thick clover. She was beautiful in the most unguarded, unaffected way. He drummed up the courage to say what he'd arranged the whole occasion for. He set his knee in the clover. He took up her hand, her arm like the string of a kite, her face floating above him with the sun lighting her auburn hair. She was suddenly so serene. The kite never panics. This time, neither did he. He couldn't believe it would happen. Not here. They would never brand a woman. This was the tower, for pity's sake. If anything, the ordeal had made him doubt the morality and sanity of his fellow tourists. How different might the tower be if the tourists would stop dragging their afflictions and flaws in with them? There were natives to the tower, Senlin knew, who had never set foot on the ground. Their minds were naturally elevated by an environment that invented and ascended. Their influence would win out. Reason would prevail. He refused to console Edith because he refused to believe she was in any real danger. An answer would come soon, and they would be freed. He gave her arm a pat-pat. It was the sort of cool reassurance he offered nervous students on a first day of class. His patting seemed to say, "There, there, it's not as bad as all that." Edith was too stunned by Seth's news to notice Senlin's feeble consolation. Despite his confidence that the registrar would offer a speedy response to their protest, night came without an answer. The cage, which had seemed so exposed before, now seemed strangely private. The stars appeared like frost on a window. The moon rose, thin as a strap. They ate the hard rolls and shared the flask of water, their quiet seeming to amplify the clamour of the market below. The sounds of flutes and fiddles and drums swelled from around numerous campfires. The songs overlapped, like the field music of crickets. The evening chill made them huddle together for warmth. Edith folded the excess of her skirts over their laps. The realization that she might be branded had stifled her previous talkativeness. As the hour grew later, Senlin felt his wellspring of optimism, of denial, begin to fail. His mind churned over the details of what Seth had said. He couldn't make sense of it, and it grated at him. He wondered what was behind all of the parlor's arbitrary rules. "This obsession with fires, doesn't it seem strange to you?" he said, finally breaking the silence. "They don't insist that we wash the dishes or sweep the floors. We only have to stoke the fires.
There must be some practical reason. Perhaps it mobilizes the air, or warms the plumbing.
It's always been part of the script, Edith said, shifting her shoulder against his. No matter what the play is about, the fires have to be kept up. I always remembered before.
You had other things on your mind, Senlin said.
You didn't forget the fires.
Only out of habit. Whenever my wife lost track of me at a pub or a party, all she had to do was follow the chimney.
I gravitate to fires.
People leave you alone if you're stirring a fire.
When you get out of here, you should find a chimney to stand near.
Her tone suggested it was a joke, but feeling Senlin wince beside her, she said,
I'm sure she's fine.
Coming here was my idea, he said.
I wanted to see the tower. I brought us here. Why was I so determined to bring her here? What's that old saying? Like water to a drain, we are drawn to the tower, she said, in a laughably formal voice. Not what you expected,
I liked it better in books. Have you ever been farther up, in the baths, or...
What comes after that?
New Babel?
This is as far as I've gone.
She picked at the tattered tulle of her skirts.
As far as I'll go.
Come on, he said, patting her hand. Even to him, it seemed a condescending gesture.
He stopped patting and squeezed her hand gently instead.
We're not staying here. You've got to go back home and lose your husband, and I've got to go on ahead and find my wife.
Maria ran her hand over the keys and along the lip of the music rack, up to the freshly polished topboard of the upright piano. She turned to Senlin with an expression of amazement.
How did you...
Senlin pulled out the piano bench for her and bumped into his hat rack. The rack shivered but didn't fall. The piano was tightly wedged inside the little living room of his cottage.
I had it shipped in from Brombury last week. It's a little old, I'm afraid. I bought it from your old conservatory. They were making room for new pianos.
A piano, Tom? You're giving me a piano?
She sat down and tested the keys, still in a daze.
I know... Most men bring a ring when they propose, he shrugged. But I thought if you were ever to live here and be happy, you would need a piano more.
She glanced about the room, realizing that it had changed.
But where is your sofa?
You're sitting on it.
He hooked his leg around the bench and sat down beside her. It swayed a little beneath them, and they both grabbed hold of the keyboard in case the old bench collapsed. When it didn't, they laughed, and she said,
It's a very comfortable sofa.
Senlin cleared his throat and furrowed his brow.
Maria, I have a difficult time expressing certain genuinely held feelings.
He swallowed and shook his head. This was not how he wanted the speech to go. She waited patiently, and he gathered his thoughts.
You've made it impossible for me to read a book in peace. When you're not here, I just gaze at the words until they tumble off the page into a puddle in my lap. Instead of reading, I sit there and review the hours of the day I spent in your company, and I'm more charmed by that story than anything the author has scribbled down. I have never been lonely in my life, but you have made me lonely. When you're gone, I'm a moping ruin. I thought I understood the world fairly well, but you have made it all mysterious again. And it's unnerving and frightening and wonderful. And I want it to continue. I want all your mysteries. And if I could, I would give you 100 pianos. I would...
She stopped him with a gentle hand on his shoulder. She rose, her hand moving to his cheek. He tried to stand and fell back onto the keyboard with a discordant bang of notes. She kissed him, shifting the bench with the side of her leg. He attempted to lift himself from the keyboard, but again she pushed him back with the force of a kiss, and again he banged upon the keys. The villagers who walked past the headmaster's cottage that evening wondered where he had gotten a piano and why he insisted on playing it so poorly and so loudly for so long. Chapter 15. Most life in the ocean lives in the shallows, and so it is with those living on the land. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. He woke to a frigid gust of wind. The coop rattled softly. The wirelinks rang like a tambourine. The sky was a deep indigo, and the starlight painted the tower the colour of a glacier. The night was as brutally cold as the day had been hot. Morning was still hours away. His arm had gone to sleep, and when he tried to shift it, he realized that Edith and he were in a tangled embrace. Her cheek pressed against his chest. His arms were around her. Her black heavy hair blew about his chin and neck. Guiltily, he began to draw back. Either she hadn't been asleep, or was jolted awake by his movement, because she quickly said,
"Please don't. I'm freezing."
Her voice was muffled. Her breath warmed his chest. He stopped, and she closed the gap he had opened. He could feel the full length of her body shivering against him. He rearranged the broadest part of his coat over her shoulders as best he could. "It'll be morning in a couple of hours. Try to get back to sleep." For him, sleep did not return. He lay in the purple dark, thinking. He couldn't reconcile his idea of the tower with his experience, and it gnawed at him. He had misled his students when he'd praised the tower so effusively. That much was certain. He would have to complicate his lesson come the fall and the new school year. He would still teach the tower's technological advances and its vague historical accounts, but he would no longer exaggerate its character. Something changed in people when they stood in the tower's shadow. It sapped their humanity. It heightened their ambition. He couldn't imagine why anyone would return to the parlour after being expelled. Why return for further torment? He didn't understand it. Was life really so grim in the market? Was everyone so terribly dissatisfied with themselves that they could think of nothing better to do with their lives than to spend it in pretend? He thought of Pining, the poor, affable sap. He'd been so effusive about the wonders of the parlour. In the moments before he was killed, he seemed so confident and satisfied and happy. But why pretend to love a woman? Why woo an actor? It didn't make any sense.
"I imagine people would pay hundreds of shekels for a room with a balcony like this," Edith said, interrupting his brooding. "Do you think we could fit a sofa in here?"
He smiled at the idea.
"I have a question, which you certainly aren't obligated to answer, but it's something that has been bothering me, so I feel compelled to ask."
"Don't make a speech, Tom. Just ask your question,"
she cut him off, though not harshly. He drew a breath.
"Why did you come back to the parlour so many times?"
She laughed and turned her face away from his chest.
"I've been asking myself the same thing. I haven't a good excuse. There's just something nice, something comforting about being in the middle of somebody else's story. It's really clarifying, in a weird way, and it feels important."
She heard Senlin sniff at this, a stunted little laugh, and she poked him in the ribs.
"Don't laugh. I know it sounds stupid, but I look at my own life, and all I see is ambivalence and confusion. Nothing dramatic happens, at least not suddenly. In real life, nothing happens quickly. Everything just erodes, and it's confusing and frustrating and dull. God, can it be dull? But then you have the parlour, and everything has a point. Yes, it's simple. Yes, it's stupid. But there is a plot. A week ago, I would have given anything for a life with a plot. Now I say, bring on the dullness.
Give me chores and almanacs and 9 hours of dreamless, exhausted sleep. Bring on the dullness.
Senlin considered all of this.
I suppose it makes sense, but I prefer the story you told me about your past to the trite play we escaped.
I think your life sounds interesting.
Then I must have exaggerated.
They paused to harden themselves against another snapping wind. He gritted his teeth and clinched his eyes shut until it passed. After it calmed again, Edith spoke, her voice abruptly lower.
I know you're in the middle of your own mess.
She turned into his chest.
I hope you find your wife. I really do. I think you will. If you can survive this, everything else has to be easy,
she said, and had to stop to clear her throat, and he realized that she was trying to keep from crying.
But I have a favor to ask. I know I don't have any right to ask, and you don't have any responsibility to say yes.
Don't make a speech, he said, trying to calm her and keep her from breaking down. Just ask the question.
Don't leave me. Till it's over. I can get through it. I just need a little moral support.
Hearing the dread in her voice, he said he would. Of course he would. But he was quick to add, it wouldn't come to that. The registrar would relent. When Seth's insufferable smile reappeared in the hatch portal the next morning, he repeated the previous verdict. Edith would be expelled. She could never come back. Seth, having studiously avoided any mention of branding or bodily harm, referred now to the ostracization process that Edith would undergo. He made it sound like the most congenial thing in the world, and he assured them there was nothing more that could be done. The alternatives and appeals had been exhausted. Senlin, having stewed on the subject all night, had prepared a fuming rebuttal.
"Have you been entirely stripped of your conscience?" he asked. "Don't hide behind duty and institution. Act like a human being. Don't behave as if this brutality is defensible just because an arbitrary policy and a bullying bureaucrat stand behind it. You do not need an appeal to confirm what you know. It is wrong to maim a person for failing to stoke a fire. You have a conscience, native to yourself, which is screaming through the bars of your very ribs. Let her go."
There was an unfamiliar heat to his voice, and he found at the end that he was trembling with rage. Seth flagged his handkerchief over his face as if to swat away a gnat.
"Here, here, a fine speech."
Senlin was taken aback by this strange response. The clerk had sounded genuine, if not a little bored.
"Thank you. But in the final analysis, it's not a matter of conscience, really. It's a matter of constancy,"
Seth said at last, with a sad, resolute smile. He swallowed a second argument. As much as he loathed giving in to this injustice, he could not argue with her request. He had promised to be a moral support. The obligation had already begun.
"Really, the ostracization process is quite humane," Seth said, with a tone that suggested much was being made of little. "For some, it's even revelatory."
Senlin had to clinch his jaw to keep from blurting a rebuke. The verdict accepted, they were allowed into the hall again. Their backs ached, and their legs quaked beneath them. They stretched and shook the blood back into their legs. He felt like a man who had crawled ashore from a stormy sea. For the second time in the past day, he felt the disbelieving gratitude of a survivor. Seth led them to the hospital ward they'd passed through the day before. A dozen white-suited attendants patrolled the tile. The attendants weaved slowly, vigilantly through the grid of curtained stalls. Pistols hung at their hips under the hems of their coats. It occurred to him that if the two of them tried to run, they would not get far. The empty beds they passed took on a more sinister light. Sobs and moans, which the tiled room amplified and duplicated mercilessly, sounded everywhere about them. And then Senlin abruptly understood. This wasn't a hospital at all. This was not where one came to be healed. This was where the unfortunate exiles were branded, or had their eyes plucked out. This was where ensnared tourists were ostracized. It was a white-tiled torture chamber. Through a gap in the curtains of one cell, Senlin briefly caught sight of a scene that was so intense it stunted the passage of time. He saw a man being held upright in bed by two attendants. Concealing the man's whole head was one of the valved copper cylinders he had seen on their first pass through the ward. The valve stood in the center of the man's unseen face, like an absurd nose. A nurse leaned over him, turning the valve in short, strained jerks. Spasms racked the man's arms and legs, testing the strength of the two attendants holding him down. Despite his obvious agony, not a single sound escaped the sealed helmet. The man writhed in silence. They were torturing him. The nurse seemed to have no qualms about it. Senlin supposed that the barbaric device was what they used to remove a person's eye. The thought filled him with disgust. A cotton gown lay on the empty, tightly made bed where Seth halted. A long curtain hung on a rod encircling the bed. Seth directed Edith to ready herself for the nurse, who would be around shortly. He called Senlin onward, babbling again about the beautiful peacocks that roosted all about the baths. But Senlin remained planted beside the curtain after Edith closed it. He could see her shadow shift behind the drape.
"I'm going to wait with her," Senlin said. "There really is no need. She will be..."
"I'm going to wait," he repeated more firmly. Seth looked genuinely puzzled. He seemed about to argue, then thought better of it. He gave a belabored shrug and removed himself some paces to scribble on a steno pad. A short, matronly woman in a cardinal red apron and nurse's cap approached, pushing a white enameled cart ahead of her. A lidded iron crock rattled atop the cart. The long handle of her brand protruded from a notch in the lid. Ignoring Senlin, the nurse peeked behind the curtain before casting it open. Edith lay under the sheet in the simple white gown that had been provided. Her tattered and stained costume lay folded at the foot of the bed. A moment before, Senlin's blood had been boiling, but the sight of her, swaddled in white sheets, was unexpectedly calming. Surely none of this was real. The nurse nattered happily about how pretty Edith was, and how nice her outfit looked, even while she set about arranging Edith's right arm, straightening it, palm up, on the bed. Edith stretched her free arm towards Senlin. He knelt by the head of the bed, taking her hand. The nurse offered her a rolled cloth to bite down on, suggesting that it helped to diffuse the pain. But Edith jerked her chin away without response. The nurse opened the iron crock with a thick leather mitt. Among the red coals, the circular brand glowed, large as a man's pocket watch. The sight made Senlin's stomach pitch. When he looked back to Edith, she was staring at him intently. Her dark hair lay fanned over the pillow. Her tanned and freckled collarbone glowed with sweat.
"Don't hang around too long. You've got somewhere to be," she said, and shifted her grip from his hand to his forearm.
Sliding on a blacksmith's leather glove, which reached to her elbow, the nurse said,
"I have to hold the iron flush for the count of three. It's very important that you don't move, dear. If it doesn't look right, we have to do it again."
Edith didn't look away from Senlin to acknowledge the nurse. Her mouth was thin and bloodless.
"To the count of three," the nurse repeated.
When the brand touched her skin, Edith's veins leapt in her neck, and her eyes gaped, and her fingernails bore into Senlin's arm, and her cheeks darkened, and the terrible but familiar scent of burning flesh filled the air, and the nurse, in a bell-clear voice, said,
"One?"
When he last saw her, Edith was lying unconscious, while the nurse wrapped her arm with gauze. Her blacking out had been a small mercy. She never cried out, and he sensed in her silence her defiance. The matron had resumed her unwonted pleasantries, despite Edith's unresponsiveness. Senlin had argued that he would stay until she had awakened, but Seth insisted that if he lingered any longer, he would have to reopen the review of Senlin's case.
"And you're becoming morbid, Mr. Senlin. You're losing sight of the prize. Galas and spas and peacocks await you," Seth said, with maddening insensitivity.
Senlin had no notion of what more he could have said to Edith in any case. Perhaps it was just as well they avoid a final, awkward farewell. She was bound for home, and he still had more of the tower to climb. He hoped she would be on her farm soon enough, hoped she could again become the generaless, and hoped that he would become just a minor actor in a horror story she'd strive to forget. How could he say all of that in a goodbye? Better to leave them both with some dignity. So much had already been taken from them. Rattled and spent from the ordeal, Senlin was silent as he was led out of the torture ward, back into the vast, officious halls. An attendant appeared with his clothes and satchel, and he was allowed to change out of his rumpled, sweat-soured butler's costume. He discovered that his money had not been stolen, but in that numb moment of depression, he found he didn't care. As he buttoned his shirt, he resolved 3 times to return to Edith's bedside. Let them throw him in jail and put a bucket on his head and unscrew his eyes. Let them try. And 3 times he convinced himself to go. Maria was waiting just up ahead. He hoped she was whole and unscarred. He wished she was there, right then, to comfort him. It was, he knew, a selfish wish. Assistant Seth seemed uncharacteristically subdued as he showed Senlin to a marble-walled stairwell. Chiseled in broad letters over the door were the words, "The Baths." Senlin had no intention of lingering on their parting, but the moment Senlin set his boot on the first step, Seth reached forward and grasped his elbow. The young man offered an abrupt and earnest confession.
"I know that was more than a little overwhelming for you. To be honest, I fear that I failed you with my own performance. You were so natural. I admire you. I had aspirations of playing the registrar myself. After this, I can't help but wonder whether I'm up to the part."
"Well, good luck," Senlin replied curtly, not grasping why the obnoxious assistant was suddenly fawning over him and divulging his professional aspirations.
"What I wanted to ask is, do you think I might be more suited to the role of a nurse? Do you think that character would be more appropriate to my talents? The role is traditionally played by a woman, but the potential for—"
Senlin butted in.
"Role? What do you mean? You're an actor."
Seth could hardly contain his delight. He bit his knuckle and blushed.
"Oh, Mr. Senlin, what a wonderful review! You have absolutely made my day!"
Part 2. The Baths. Chapter 1. The fountain of the baths can unwrinkle a crone's elbow, can mend sprained muscles and strained hearts alike, can dislodge the most stubborn tick. Whatever is worrisome will be forgot. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. A troop of chattering young women in felt dresses and crocheted hats followed him up the switchbacking stairs. Their stairwell converged with another, then a third, until their upward path joined a great confluence, steps of pink marble, wide as a city block. The footfalls of ascending tourists chorused like falling rain, growing from a rhythmless patter into a thunderous beat. He was one of thousands making the climb. The Everyman's Guide called the baths the Nurse of Humanity, though Senlin's faith in the literature was not what it had been. His time in the cage had stiffened his joints. His legs burned and shook. When he mounted the last step, he wanted to collapse, but there simply was no room. Without a moment to regain his breath, he was jostled forward into one of many queues inside the crowded customs station. The white porcelain brickwork gleamed in the gaslight of bronze chandeliers. Men in navy blue uniforms patrolled and scanned the crowd. Billy clubs and rapiers hung from their belts. The black leather bills of their blue caps hid their eyes, but Senlin could feel the uniformed agents watching him, watching them all. At the end of the great hall, some 100 yards ahead, a bank of caged customs booths stood, sturdy as molars. This was the only